der Podcast für Religion und Zeitfragen.
RefLab. Ihr Lieben, herzlich willkommen zur Theo Lounge. Heute mit einem besonderen Gast, mit David Gashi. Ich werde ihn nachher ausführlicher vorstellen. Hier eine kurze Vorwarnung. Das Gespräch findet auf Englisch statt. Er ist ein Freund aus den USA, ein bekannter Ethiker, der ein breites Werk an Büchern verfasst hat und auch einige Kontroverse auf sich gezogen hat. Ich freue mich sehr, mit ihm zu sprechen heute, eben im Weiteren auf Englisch. David Gashi, it's a pleasure to have you here. You are very welcome in Switzerland. How did you land in Zurich?
Everything is good. It's good to be with you, Manuel. I flew from Atlanta yesterday. Atlanta to Amsterdam, everything was delayed. It was to say it was a long trip to get here, but I am glad to be here.
Yeah. I heard you came in here in Zurich yesterday and you already got introduced to one of our national meals. You had raclette for the evening. That's kind of a dangerous meal to eat if you're looking for a good night's sleep, but I heard you managed well.
Yes, a very late raclette, but a lovely conversation with friends here.
Wonderful. David, you are professor for Christian ethics at Mercy University. Some introductory notes here for our audience. You are author, co-author, editor of more than 25 books. Some of them I've read and looked into, and it's very inspiring to see what topics you cover, and also and we will talk about that later, also the journey, the theological and spiritual journey you went on, and that's also reflected in your books. You also led significant activist efforts on climate, on torture question, and LGBTQ inclusion. And you are also a podcaster. You have a podcast called Kingdom Ethics with Jeremy Hall.
Right, though we haven't been as active on that recently. I'm on podcasts in the USA, seems like every week. So I'm not sure that I need my own podcast anymore. But
yeah, but yes. I was searching your name on Spotify, and there are like you say, 30 different podcasts with you on it. So let's make a quick quiz game, and you have to take sides: Marvel or DC Comics?
DC.
McDonald's or Subway?
Subway.
Carl Barth or Paul Tillich?
Barth.
E-books or printed physical books?
Print, for sure.
American football or real football? I mean, European soccer.
American football.
Hoodie or shirt?
Hoodie.
Narnia or Lord of the Rings?
Narnia.
That's a tricky one.
Yes.
Yeah. Pepsi or Coca-Cola?
Coke.
K-pop or country music?
A K-pop.
Okay. Surprising answer. Christmas or Easter?
Christmas.
Cats or dogs?
Cats.
Netflix or cinema?
Netflix.
Gummy bears or that's a tricky one because there is only one right answer. Gummy bears or chocolate?
Chocolate. I know where I am.
You know where. Okay, good. You saved that one.
That's right.
that was close. David, you are born Catholic, but you had a pretty radical conversion experience in the Southern Baptist movement, and you had a deep insight into the evangelical world, the evangelical scene. What I discovered when I looked on what you've written, you've always allowed yourself to think outside of the box. You did your doctoral studies at the Union Theological Seminary. That's not an evangelical seminary at all. It's more, much more on the liberal side. You did your dissertation topic not on some like inside evangelical question, but on Christians who saved Jews in the time of Holocaust. And for some years now, you've become in a sense, the official relocation assistant for people who want to find their way out of U.S. evangelicalism into a new, freer, healthier faith. You also wrote a book on your biographical journey. Can you give us a brief outline? So what makes a Southern Baptist Christian into someone who leads evangelicals from Egypt to the Promised Land?
I now have a new title to put on my bio, official relocation assistant out of evangelicalism. I like that. I like that one. I had not heard that one before. Well, it's been quite a ride. The main spiritual influence in my childhood was my mother, who was a devout Irish Catholic. Hmm. So she took us to church. My father was not very cooperative at that time. I don't know that I ever gave Catholicism at that time a fair chance. Mm. I left it at the age of 14, but I was always a very spiritually minded young man. I was interested in spiritual things, supernatural things. I even dabbled in the occult and things like that. I knew I was never going to be a materialist. Something spiritual mattered to me always. Yeah. I wandered into a Southern Baptist church when I was 16 years old because I knew a young lady who was there. that often helps. And,
yeah.
And I had a radical, as you said, a radical conversion experience as a 16-year-old. And so I got very deeply involved in Southern Baptist Christianity. I joined the youth group. I was deeply shaped by what I would still say at the time was a pretty healthy version of Christianity. I mean, it was conservative, but it was Jesus-centered. It was loving. It was healthy, mm-hmm. much healthier than what we see today. I became, Mr. Southern Baptist for a while. So I went to Southern Baptist Seminary. By the time I was finishing at Southern, I felt like I needed a broader experience. I decided to go to Union in New York. I wanted something outside of the South and outside of that subculture. And that, I mean, Union was very different from Southern Baptists, and it was a shock to the system, and I didn't always enjoy it, but I'm glad that I went there. While I was at Union, it was a 6-year journey, doctoral journey, and for the last 3 years, I worked in Philadelphia for a man named Ron Sider. Ron Sider wrote Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. He just died, my dear friend. Yeah. And he introduced me to the evangelical world of Canada and North America, Canada and the U.S., but the progressive end of the evangelical world, which I found very appealing. Sometimes known as peace and justice evangelicalism, associated with names like Jim Wallis, Tony Campolo, now, Shane Claiborne, yeah. Sider, the evangelical left, it was sometimes called. And so I fit there. And so that was when I first embraced the evangelical label for myself. And for 20 years, that worked for me. And I built a career, became pretty successful, wrote books that people read in the evangelical world, like Kingdom Ethics, the textbook, and was all over the evangelical world. If there was some obscure evangelical college or church somewhere, I probably spoke there.
I got a copy of your Kingdom Ethics like 15 years ago. There was the some editions before you also changed your position on some use, and I still have it.
Yeah.
And it took a while until I realized that's the Gashi we are meeting now.
That's right. That was me. Yeah. I would say that I had points of tension with evangelicalism, but it was built in. I understood that there was a right wing and a left wing of evangelicalism, that I was on the left side, that the conservative politics never attracted me, ever.
Yeah.
I did like the spiritual passion and the commitment to scripture and the meaningful community. But the political stuff became more and more important. As it became more and more important in defining American evangelicalism, it became more and more of a problem for me. And it turned out that whatever conservative Republicans were doing, evangelicals were supporting no matter what. including, for example, this was pretty pivotal, torturing people after 9/11.
Yeah.
And I was a leader, maybe the leader of the evangelical resistance to that. But there are other issues too. But the main decisive one was LGBTQ inclusion. I wrote a book in 2014 called Changing Our Mind, in which I documented, and actually as I was writing it, I was changing my mind. That was kind of the process that was illuminated by that book. And after that, the attacks from conservative evangelicals were fierce.
Yeah, I imagine.
I attempted to, what I was trying to do was say, hey, evangelicals, can we have this conversation? And they said no and kicked me out.
Yeah.
But, I mean, anybody can call themselves an evangelical, and I continue to do it for a while. But there are a lot of people who have discovered my work just in these last 8 years, from Changing Our Mind. And then I wrote a little memoir called Still Christian, in which I reflected on some my own journey and whether I was still following Jesus or whether my critics were right that I had jumped the rails and was heading straight to hell. And then this is where I become relocation assistant for evangelicals who are leaving. I wrote this book called After Evangelicalism, yeah, in which I try to propose new theological and ethical ways forward for post-evangelicals. And that book is really having some impact, I can tell. So I still go to Baptist church. I also go to Catholic church with my wife. So I'm still a church person. I still get up every morning and read the Bible and pray. Still a follower of Jesus. But I probably would be seen as one of the most determined post-evangelicals in the country. As in, I really think that evangelicalism in America is sick. And I'm a pretty strong critic.
Yeah, yeah. Let's elaborate on that a little bit. You already tapped into what I wanted to ask next. The kind of the changing of the Christian landscape. I mean, as far as I could tell, the last year, either something very profoundly shifted inside of the evangelical churches or movements, or something got revealed that was there before. I recall the quote from Bill Maher that was right like days before Donald Trump got elected and everyone was still expecting Hillary Clinton to win. And he said, we must all thank Donald Trump for the one good thing he did. He exposed evangelicals as the shameless hypocrites they've always been. And there was like thunderous applause in the audience when he said that. So, is it this? Is like the Donald Trump phenomenon, which really also appalled me and kind of estranged me totally from everything that's called evangelical. Mm-hmm. Is it really that he revealed something, or is it that something shifted very, very fast?
I think it's important to take the long view. So let's just linger here for just a minute, if that's okay. Modern American evangelicalism came out of what's called the fundamentalist modernist controversy of the early 20th century, as Protestantism was dividing between its inerrantist fundamentalists and its more modern thinking people. People who accepted biblical criticism, people who accepted the theory of evolution. Fundamentalism was on the right wing, okay? And for a long time, fundamentalism was losing in Protestantism in the United States. Most of the denominations were under the control of the modernists. In the 1940s, the fundamentalists, there was a movement from within the fundamentalists to try to create a third way, a path that was more positive, more attractive, a little bit less rigid. And this became evangelicalism. This was the label that was developed.
Yeah.
The word evangelical goes back further, but this was the word that was appropriated by this group. People like Carl Henry and Billy Graham.
Exactly. It was kind of the label for the, not for the extremist ones, but for the moderate ones.
That's right. They were the moderate fundamentalists.
Yeah.
Right. But they didn't want the word fundamentalist. It had a bad association at that time. Still does, really. So the evangelical word was better. So that this happened during and after World War II. And the evangelicals built a powerful subculture in the United States. Mm. For while they, and this was a white-dominated movement, it was a male-dominated movement, it was always conservative, though it was not in the beginning fundamentally about politics. It was about evangelism, and it was about attempting to be a voice between fundamentalism and mainline moderate, or mainline liberalism, basically. Yeah. Beginning in the late 1970s, radicalized by the social changes of the 60s, including the civil rights movement and the sexual revolution and all of that, anti-Vietnam and all the social divisions that hit America, this group moved towards a political strategy. And that strategy was embodied by people like Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority Movement. And it was embraced by the Republican Party. And so a marriage, you might say that the conservative white Christians coalesced as a political movement, and they got married to the Republican Party.
Yeah.
They certainly got in bed with the Republican Party. And that partnership has now gone on for 50 years. And one of the things that happened was that evangelicals and fundamentalists and Pentecostals and eventually conservative Catholics and conservative Eastern Orthodox people and everybody who was conservative, this became the headquarters of the right wing of the American culture wars. Mm. And evangelicalism in particular became known for its hardline politics and its loyalty to the Republican Party and Republican positions and Republican politicians, no matter who they were or what they did.
Yeah.
So that went from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush. But it was a step much further to get to Donald Trump. I consider Donald Trump, he's hardly Republican. He's more like George Wallace, the segregationist politician from Alabama in the 1960s and 70s. He's more like Huey Long, the populist governor of Louisiana, or Joseph McCarthy of the Red Scare. Or he's basically the worst embodiment of our populist, xenophobic, racist strand of our politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he gets elected president, and what I think happened was, I mean, he barely got elected president, but he gave permission for the worst strand of our culture to come out to play.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he has helped to redefine evangelicalism a long way away from what Billy Graham and Carl Henry wanted it to be in the 1940s. To something more like a right-wing political movement. And there was an interesting poll that was done not long ago where it was discovered that the word evangelical, even for those who embrace it, has less of a religious identifier now and more of a political one.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of people, if you ask them, are you an evangelical? They say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then what does that mean? Well, make America great again.
Yeah. So you would say something has shifted indeed. There, something has changed. I mean, I recall you wrote a book in, I think in 2008, called The Future of Faith in American Politics. And you actually make the case there that evangelicals are by no means this monolithic, conservative, right-wing, white Republican movement, but that there is also a strong progressive center-left political segment. And you kind of predicted there or hoped for the moderates to rise or to grow, and something changed right. in this time. So I don't think that you would write the same book again now.
That looks hopelessly naive. But what's interesting is 2008 was the year that Barack Obama was elected president.
Yeah.
And he got the support of something like 24% of evangelicals. So I would have been in that group. But I think that Obama inflamed his very existence and his presidency inflamed American racism.
Yeah.
And being anti-Obama became more and more definitive of evangelicals. And so the evangelical left the center disappeared. The left, people like Ron Sider, who just died, and Shane Claiborne and so on, Jim Wallace, largely, though not exclusively, stopped defining themselves as evangelicals.
Yeah.
They moved into the post-evangelical camp or some other label because the space for an evangelical left has been shrinking.
Yeah. So I wouldn't blame them, but of course, if kind of the left wing of the whole movement is exiling out of evangelical, not self-describing themselves as evangelical, then the remaining rest will be very right wing or much more conservative, much more right wing than before. I think you are talking about like 20 million post-evangelical refugees, or how do you call it?
I mean, I think you can put different numbers on it. It kind of depends on how evangelicals are defined.
Yeah.
But I would say 20 million is not a bad opening guess for, if you define them this way, people who once participated in a serious way in the evangelical subculture. So they were in evangelical denominations. They went to evangelical churches. They read evangelical books. They were part. They sang evangelical songs.
Yeah.
Lord, I lift your name on high. Right. You know.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of those songs are here too. Right.
Yeah.
And now, through a variety of paths, they are out. For some, it really was Trump. In a lot of evangelical churches in 2015, 2016, it became clear that if you did not support Trump, you were not a good Christian.
Yeah. Period. Yeah.
And for the millions and millions and millions of evangelicals who just, not only did they not agree, they were violently opposed to that idea that, in fact, they were convinced that the opposite was true, right? So they were out. But part of what the ex-evangelical, it's called sometimes in the U.S., mm-hmm. ex-evangelical, hashtag ex-evangelical, yeah. and post-evangelicals, which is the phrase that I use, there are a lot of paths out. In some ways, the path, you have the older paths out, like the path of I take science seriously, and the evangelicals seem to not, right? So climate change,
right,
or evolution was the original one, or the rigid, infallible, inerrant Bible understanding. That's an old argument, and right. and that's been a path out consistently for people, or the patriarchy where women are not allowed to serve as leaders, or the evidence of toxic masculinity and sexual abuse in evangelical churches. Mm. That's a path out for a lot of people.
And then for a lot of people, it was the LGBTQ
issue. It was the LGBTQ yeah. issues. And then for others, it was race, you know, when we saw a lot of racist right. stuff happening. But Trump, who has been the dominant cultural phenomenon in our country now for 7 long years.
Yeah.
Trump. I just want him to go away. So that sick man has both made evangelicalism worse and revealed the toxic underbelly for what was already there. And that has driven a lot of people out of evangelicalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've met pastors who found leading their churches unsustainable because they were expected to signal or to say directly, you know, go Trump, we're all for Trump. And when they wouldn't do it, they were forced out.
Yeah. I heard about stories like this too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not from Europe, but from the US, of course. Yeah. Well, we will move on to more like cultural and political topics, but one last question. Try to paint it in like broad strokes. What would be for the future of, let's say, of US evangelicalism? What would be the worst case scenario? What would be the best case scenario? And what would you consider a realistic scenario?
Well, worst case scenario is white evangelicalism, and we're mainly talking about a white phenomenon here, white people, white evangelicalism becoming more and more, dare I say it, neo-fascist, more openly racist, more openly masculinist, more openly politicized, more openly cruel, anti-immigrant, vicious. I wrote an article recently where I talked about what I call toxic Christianism. I was talking about specific politicians who are flamboyantly Christian and flamboyantly mean and toxic. And some of our worst public officials are the most visibly Christian. So evangelicalism then isn't just hypocritical, it's worse at that point. It's a descent into a little bit like the Deutsche Christen movement in Germany in the 1930s.
That would be worst case.
That's worst case, yeah. And I think there's some of that now. But best case, that slide down the slope into evil, idolatrous quasi-Christianity is marginalized as a kind of a bad turn that most people gradually recognize was a bad turn. And there's a reform from within evangelicalism as people remember their first love.
Right.
And they remember that Jesus had nothing to do with any of that. He was not like that. He is not like that. There's nothing in keeping with the Christian virtues there. In other words, a recovery of Jesus and the best resources of the Bible. And a remembrance of a better day when evangelicals were known for things like, beautiful lives and beautiful worship services and a love of Scripture and a love of Jesus, right? So you might say renewal from within.
Yeah.
But what I think is we can't wait for renewal from within, because real life people need to make decisions now as to what they're going to do about their religious affiliation and about their faith. And so this is why we have this massive post-evangelical movement developing. And I mean, I don't think there's going to be a widespread change on LGBTQ inclusion. So even if, no matter what happens, I think that evangelicalism is going to remain defined by exclusion. Maybe a polite exclusion, but
still
exclusion. So in any case, the post-evangelical movement is going to grow. And so in that endless kind of churn of religious community, just as you might say you had the mainline liberals and the fundamentalists, and then evangelicals were born in the middle. Now coming 70 years later, 80 years later, coming out of evangelicalism is a post-evangelicalism that is going to grow.
Yeah.
And so I guess I hope that this post-evangelical world will also will develop the needed structures and the needed leaders and the needed churches, congregations, podcasts, books, authors, guides in that journey. Because for a lot of the post-evangelicals, they are traumatized, and they don't just need like a place to go to church. They need healing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a good insight here. I would love to talk with you more about what chances you see for like post-evangelical, ex-evangelicals to move on and build something like new churches that don't function the same way as the evangelical churches did. I want to broaden the focus a little bit and talk about like society and culture. And I have to admit, of course, because I've only been to the US a couple of times for a couple of weeks, what I get from the US is shaped by the media I consume. It's shaped by the TV shows I watch. I love Stephen Colbert and Trevor Noah, and especially John Oliver. But I also especially on Facebook and Instagram, I am maybe the algorithm works that way, but I get fed by videos of Russell Brand, Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, Bill Maher, and the impression I get from what I see from the US, from the media, the impression is that the climate is rapidly intensifying, that the fronts are hardening, and all sorts of things are being dragged into the culture war. I'm very much into TV series. I'm kind of a series junkie, so Netflix and HBO and you name it. And the discussions around those series, if some new series is coming up now, the Rings of Power, the Lord of the Rings right. prequel, and it's always, people don't talk about the story anymore. It's always only about, well, they included black people into the Tolkien universe. For some, that's kind of a sacrilege, and for others, well, there are no trans elves, so I'm not watching the show. And it's just crazy. Everything gets dragged into the culture war, and do I have a too dramatic picture of the American society? Do I only get the extremes at the edges, or would you confirm my impression?
I've just finished a book that will be my next book. It's coming out next year, and it's called Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies.
That's a good title. We get some heat for that.
And it actually proposes that this is a global phenomenon now, especially in the Christian and post-Christian lands. And I have chapters on Russia, Hungary, Poland, Brazil, and the U.S., as well as historical studies of France and Germany in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And my big picture hypothesis is that anti-liberal, anti-modernism, as defining intellectual movements and as sweeping through Christianity, conservative Christianity, has been a steady theme in all of those places. And I've also been listening more closely to the conservatives to see what it is they're so upset about. And a phrase that I wonder if you have this phrase here that sticks with me is woke totalitarianism.
Yeah.
And so the accusation is wokeness, wokeisme, wokeism, meaning hyper excessive liberal identity politics. But then that covers, let's face it, the conservatives are partly reacting against the displacement of straight white male dominance in culture, straight white male Christian dominance in culture, and the transgender reality and queer people being visible and a lot of people of color being centered. And it's about diversity and pluralism and inclusion, making the reactionaries get more and more angry, right?
Yeah.
So the accusation on the right is woke totalitarianism is dominating culture and must be pushed back against at every turn. But where this becomes political is a couple things. The Republican Party now essentially has little more of an agenda other than opposing wokeness.
Yeah, it's an agenda against.
Against. But, the liberal project of what's sometimes called identity politics or inclusion all the time, right? And so democracy is threatened because there are people who are so appalled by the progressive advances that they appear willing to set aside democracy in order to stop them. Stop these social changes.
Okay, that's the move, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or that's the thought right. behind it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're willing to lower your like democracy standards to push the right thing.
To win this culture war. And so that's why anything can become a culture wars battle. It could be critical race theory being taught in school, or the accusation that it's taught in school, or transgender athletes, or black characters in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or who won the Academy Awards? Or what our children are reading in fifth grade, right? Mm-hmm. So unlike in Europe, it seems to me that the social forces pushing for progressive change and the social forces pushing back against progressive change, while they may not be equal, they're close in power.
Yeah.
Let's say it's 30% hardline progressives pushing for progressive change and 28% hardline conservatives pushing against progressive change, and a lot of people in the middle not knowing what to do. Yeah. Maybe they're not. Not everybody is into this stuff all the time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So you don't want to be... I mean, you don't want to overread this because of what you pick up on in our, you know, talk shows and stuff, because it isn't every average person who thinks about this all the time.
Yeah, and the extremes are always the loudest voices you hear.
Right. And then the other thing that's really unhealthy is this has gotten identified with party politics. Yeah. We only have two parties in our country that matter. The Republicans have embraced the anti-progressive side. That's one reason why Trump was popular, was because he hit all those notes too. And the Democrats in general have embraced the progressive side, though there are people within those coalitions who are a little different from these extremes, right?
Yeah.
One reason Biden was able to win the election and would probably win again, even though he'll be 82 years old in 2024, is because there is a group of like moderate people who are not into all of this, and they just want decent government and something to be fairly normal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so the normal vote is maybe 8% or something, and that can swing elections.
Yeah,
yeah.
You already tapped into it a little bit, but what I would be interested in, what role did Christians play in the whole, or do Christians play in the whole culture war thing going on? And then more on a more hopeful note, what role could they play or should they play as Christians, as let's say it, as followers of Jesus, what role could they play?
Well, conservative Christians generally are all in on the conservative side of the culture wars. And again, not everybody's an activist.
Yeah.
But lots of rank and file, average conservative Catholics and evangelicals and fundamentalists and Pentecostals, they instinctively reject the liberal side of the culture. So they're not, maybe they've grown accustomed to a little bit of LGBT inclusion, but they're uneasy about transgender realities, or maybe they feel like culture is pushing this too hard and they wish people would just kind of throttle it back a little bit. But in among the leadership, you have priests and bishops on the Catholic side, and you have pastors and leaders on the Protestant side, some of whom are very much active partisans in the culture wars. But then you have others who are just trying to lead their churches and do normal church life. I mean, their convictions are conservative, but they're not culture warriors.
Yeah.
So my hope would be that, I mean, I'm a pastor. I'm ordained. I'm Reverend Dr. David Gushy. I think that when you lead a church, you need to try to be able to shepherd your whole flock. And culture warring by definition is divisive. And you lose and offend lots of people who need the ministry of the church and the love of Jesus. And so I don't think that church leaders should be culture warriors, period.
Yeah.
Left or right. I think they've got a different calling. Mm. So my hope is that our seminaries will train, intentionally examine these issues and train ministers who understand that the work of the church and the vocation of the minister is not culture warring. It's something very different. Mm, mm. And there are plenty of ministers who get that and are not wanting to do culture wars. They just want to preach the gospel and care for the sick and, you know, do ministry, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I do think that in general, slowly, the progressive side's values are winning in America, as they have here in Europe, Western Europe especially.
Yeah.
But it's going to be noisy and messy, and it may end up being even more bloody, literally bloody, before this all gets resolved.
Yeah, yeah.
And I the January 6th insurrection, where people died and a lot of police officers were hurt and so on, is a radical moment in our history, because a lot of Christians stormed the barricades that day, and Christian prayers were said from the rostrum of the United States Senate. Holy war, crusading Christianity, where people are not just doing metaphorical culture wars, they're willing to kill.
Yeah, to take up arms.
This is real. It's not everybody. It's a fringe, but it is this extremist Christian extremism, usually white Christian extremism, is heavily armed Christian extremism, given all the guns in our culture.
Yeah.
It's a real thing, and I'm really worried about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's frightening, and I totally understand, like, the impulse to, I mean, if pastors are invested into culture wars, they are becoming absorbed by it, and all the energy they have and all the resources they have, they will put into this culture war. That's a horrible thing. But I'm still asking myself, well, you said they should only they should care for the poor and preach the gospel. Well, the gospel has some pretty strong political implications too. Right. And so I'm still struggling with the question. Well, let's say there would be a third way beyond left and right, would be just to abstain from everything political and kind of draw back into Christian subculture and not care about anything that's going on. But that would not be what you, if I read you correctly, it would not be what you would recommend. So how do I, because sometimes things are at stake that you would connect very close to the gospel. You would say, well, if regarding, let's say, how we treat refugees, how we are invested in, I don't know, we have this discussion in Europe about the war in the Ukraine, the Russian war. What's our role here? And there are some very strong opinions around from Christians who think that the gospel is at stake here. And so how do you navigate through this tension of not tapping into the trap of culture wars, but not retrieving into a apolitical Christianity either?
I supervise PhD students now, and I actually have a student who is dealing with exactly this issue of apolitical evangelical withdrawal. I understand why it's happening, because of all the toxic stuff in politics, right? And all the divisions and so on. And it's interesting that the Catholic church that I attend with my wife, the priests there over these last years have stayed resolutely out of any kind of political talk and rarely even draw some potentially obvious political moral implications of gospel passages that are being read in the lectionary. So they're just staying out of it.
Yeah.
And yes, it's true that that's not satisfying because, you know, you say the passages, Matthew 25, the sheep and the goats parable, as you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. When I was in prison, you visited me. There are some rather obvious applications.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. And if you don't draw them, that's not responsible preaching, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and the thing is, our divisions are so profound that if a person then says, okay, that's true, I need to draw the implications where they are obvious. The problem is that progressive-leaning, justice, social justice-oriented types tend to draw conclusions that are predictably progressive.
Of course.
And read as liberal. So we need to care for refugees. That means we must oppose this and that policy at the border, or we need to open the borders, or we need to do this or that. And then they're just heard as taking the Democratic side in policy debates, right? Or conservative pastors see the political implications differently, and so they're talking in different ways about what the implications are. Jesus says a man, you know, leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife, and the two become one flesh. So obviously that means that gay people can't get married, say the conservative pastors.
Yeah.
So that means we need to try to get that Supreme Court decision reversed.
There you have it.
And there you have it, right? Yeah. So it's a paradox, and it's a painful one, because even the political implications of gospel texts track, the interpretation thereof track left and right. So it seems like you can go to a church and you have three options. You can get an apolitical message and you don't have to worry about all that politics. Or you can get a political message, one that leans left or one that leans right.
Yeah.
We don't have hardly anybody who seems able to, I tried to do this when I was preaching, but it's hard, to draw the implications in such a way that you would not necessarily know how they vote, who sometimes draws implications that sound conservative and sometimes draws implications that sound progressive that do not easily map onto our left versus right culture wars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I, to build on that, what I get from your books is you at several times or at several passages, you kind of plead for epistemological humility to recognize that even when we are, or especially when we are dealing with holy texts, especially when we are dealing with the Bible, we don't have this unmediated access to what the text really means or really says. We are always interpreters, and we are always in need of a community that helps us understand the text, in need of research to understand the text, how it was understood back then, and it's just we have to kind of, well, it doesn't solve every problem, but it surely helps to kind of take out the heat of the discussion if everyone would agree that they could be wrong, or they could not see something that right, would be very relevant and not get it right. So if we would bring that to the table, it would kind of civilize the discussion, I hope.
Even that is not universally agreed. On the fundamentalist and evangelical side, they want more epistemological certainty and less epistemological humility.
Yeah.
So you can't even get agreement about that. But yes, you have read me right that I am calling for epistemological humility. And part of what we bring to our reading of holy texts is it's everything that comes from behind our eyes. It's the lenses that we use to read texts. And those lenses, this is a fundamental insight of modern theology. Those lenses are political, they're social location based, they're everything that we are, everything that we've experienced is brought into the reading experience. Yeah. And so nobody is unbiased, nobody is unaffected by how they were raised and where they sit in the social landscape of their society. Mm-hmm. And so that ought to bring some humility. And the fundamental affirmation, I could be wrong, but what I think I see here is this. But that spirit opens up dialogue.
Exactly.
As opposed to shutting it down.
Yeah.
You know, I think I see this. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of ironic that you will find among Christians, among churches, some of the most opinionated and the most, let's say, the most sure people on earth, while we would have the chance and every reason to be humble regarding our faith in a God and our consciousness that we are only humans. You know what I want to say is the church could be the one community on earth that has an intrinsic motive to bring humility to the table, to bring even curiosity to the table regarding other people's opinions, because they kind of, they have this, it should be built into their faith that they differentiate themselves from God, who has the overview or who knows everything and doesn't get anything wrong. You know, what I want to say? There would be reason, and there would also be a great opportunity.
Yeah. Because if one really believes in God, then there is always a transcendent reference point, and there's always the recognition, I believe in God and I am not God.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so therefore, and if we believe that humans are sinful, that everything about human life has been negatively affected by sin, which I do believe, that includes our capacity to discern truth.
Yeah.
So we actually have good theological reasons for humility. It should come naturally to us to realize that I could be wrong because I am a partial, frail, fallible, sinful person.
Exactly.
But what I think I see is this, and so let's have a conversation among partial, fallible, frail, sinful people and see what we come up with, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so we ought to be better positioned than our atheist sisters and brothers, perhaps, who maybe get very, very certain about what they believe and don't have that transcendent reference point, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
But yet, of course, we are often not that humble. We are the opposite.
That's the problem, yeah. So I have to bring our talk to a close, but I want you to get into one more topic, or let's say to ask one closing question. Your most recent book is called Introducing Christian Ethics. And you that's not in that book, but I think it's in After Evangelicalism and probably in some other writings of yours. You plead for a Christian humanism. So what I would like to hear from you, and I think it fits with what we just discussed, but what is Christian about your ethics? Because you also have some kind of a universalistic approach or universal moral standards you want to apply. What is Christian about your ethics? Is there some special obligations followers of Jesus are kind of put under?
In Introducing Christian Ethics, I try to say that the moral dimension of human life, the question of how should we live, and the impulse to ask and answer that question, is universal. If you ever hear anybody say, he should not have done that, what she should have done was this, they're doing ethics.
Yeah.
So my assertion is that just as there are other aspects of human life that appear to be universal, like the desire for meaningful work or the desire for meaningful community.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the moral sense is universal.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the most interesting things, I'm an ethicist, so this maybe not surprise you, but one of the interesting things about humanity is all the different answers that people have given to the question, how should we live this life?
Mm-hmm.
Some of those answers overlap a lot, and some of them are very different. Christian ethics always should ask and answer that question with reference to Jesus Christ.
Right.
Always we have both his example and his teachings and the tradition associated with his name.
Yeah.
So it's not Christian ethics if the question, how should we live, is not shaped by the centrality of Jesus. So that's what I would say. And Christian humanism is just a phrase I used to say, I think that this ethic around Jesus should lead us toward a humane participation in the plight and in the hope for the flourishing of all human beings and a healthy creation for all life.
Mm.
And it's humanism in the sense that it cares deeply about the human condition and human well-being, and it also respects our fellow human beings as fellow questers for the good, the right, and the true. It sets us in a position not of opposition, but of partnership with the best in humanity.
Yeah.
And we're also paying attention to what thoughtful people are saying and thinking all over the world and in other traditions too. And you can see how this would all be contrasted with a prideful, separatist version of Christianity in which we're the only ones who know anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're the only ones who've ever learned anything that is true. And the rest of the world is full of our enemies.
Yeah, exactly. That's
what I want to oppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this inclusive rendering of ethics. And I think I also really like the way you kind of tied the whole thing back to the person of Jesus Christ, because that's sometimes, you know, I think in my mainline churches, one problem I see is that the church is, most of the people in the churches, they are very aware of the social problems, and they want to be invested in, let's say, in ecological questions and awareness, in social issues. They want to help the poor, and they really do. They are want to be LGBTQ inclusive and everything. But sometimes it feels like the kind of the unique, to take a word from the marketplace, the unique selling point gets lost, mm-hmm, of churches. It's kind of, it feels like it's just a doubling of what every decent person would also do and say. And if you ask, yeah, well, what's Christian about the whole thing? It's just every decent person wants to care for the weak and the poor and the lost, and wants to kind of leave a world to the next generation that's not totally destroyed and everything. So it's just, what's the Christian thing? What's the unique voice of the church? Do we just kind of echo what every decent person and politician is also saying? And if I understand you right, you would say, well, there is something we are tied back to the person of Jesus Christ. And it's also, I would add, it's also kind of the source of energy for a lot of our ethical involvement.
I'm so struck by the description you just offered of that dynamic, because we have the same issue in the U.S. too. And I think it goes back to some of the tragedy of the fundamentalist modernist controversy of 100 years ago, because the fundamentalists always said, the problem with you mainline liberals is that all you have is the social justice stuff, and you don't have Jesus anymore, and you don't have passion anymore.
Yeah.
And they were concerned that the social gospel movement, people like Walter Rauschenbusch and the whole peace and justice side, that all they were going to have was social causes and not Jesus. Mm. And I think there's a reason to be concerned about that on the mainline side. But it raises this question. If all that church people on that side amount to is good liberal values, what does church add? Why go to church?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
What does church add? I mean, I can get good liberal values by reading the New York Times editorial page. You know, why do I need to go to church? So that's one reason why a kind of tepid, not very profound, not very Jesus-centered mainline Protestantism doesn't do much for me. And that's why I would say that I'm post-evangelical rather than mainline.
Yeah.
Because I've been in mainline churches. I've spoken in mainline churches where I don't hear a lot about Jesus and I don't hear a lot about the Bible. And I remember one time visiting a mainline church to speak. And I said, I want us to study the Bible today. Do you all have Bibles here? And they were like, hold on, let me look. I think it's in the closet over there. We might have we might have a collection of old dusty Bibles that we could get out and dust off and we can bring out and talk about. And nobody will know where anything is. You'll have to tell them what page it's on, you know.
Yeah. And that is in the Old Testament. That's the first part of the thing.
yeah. You want to go, you know, here, let me see. Let me find the page number. That's page 321 in your Bible. I really don't. That's not the kind of Christian that I am. That's not what I want. So if anybody ever wonders about me, and I hear it in you too, Manuel, like, that's not what we're going for here. What I want, at least, is passionate, Jesus-centered Christianity that loves the poor the way Jesus did and for the reason that Jesus did.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that really knows, you know, where the book of Job is and knows where you can find Philippians 2. And so call me an evangelical, you know? So we need Holy Spirit and the power of the Holy Spirit. We need passion. We need love. We need energy. We need Jesus. And so, but we don't need all of that to be identified with right-wing politics.
Yeah, exactly. So I love those closing words of yours. David Gashi, it was a huge privilege to talk to you. Awesome to get to know you. And I will also link in the podcast description your website. There are additional resources of yours, audio and video and texts and everything. So you guys listening to the podcast, you can knock yourselves out with additional David Gashi resources. Thank you for being here, David.
Thank you for having me. Great to meet your community, and I hope we can talk again.
Yes.